I'm Nicholas Delange, and it gives me great pleasure to have the privilege and opportunity to introduce this year's Yerusha lecturer, or Yerusha, we should say, really. Yerusha is the Hebrew word for heritage, and the funding for this annual lecture, which is our sort of showcase lecturer on Jewish studies, comes from the Righteous Persons Foundation in Los Angeles in America. And it comes from the money that was left over after the making of the film Schindler's List. Steven Spielberg wanted to do some good things with the money to promote the Jewish heritage. And we persuaded him that a good small thing to do would be to fund an annual lecture here, and that's what we do. And the Yerusha lecturer for 2012 is Norbert M. Samuelson, whom I shall now introduce to you. Norbert holds the Grossman Chair of Jewish Studies in the Department of Religious Studies at Arizona State University. He's an internationally renowned scholar of Jewish philosophy, the author of 12 books and more than 200 articles. I haven't counted them myself, but that's what I believe. He is the founder and secretary of the Academy of Jewish Philosophy. Professor Samuelson's scholarship focuses on Jewish philosophy and theology. In the early part of his career, he wrote primarily on medieval Jewish philosopher. His pioneer work on a 14th century Jewish philosopher, Gersonides, Levi ben Gershom, his book Gersonides on God's Knowledge, published in 1977, propelled that hitherto little-known thinker for English language readers to the forefront of their consciousness and scholarship on medieval Jewish philosophy. Going beyond the history of Jewish philosophy, Professor Samuelson has written four major constructive philosophic theological works. The First 7 Days, a philosophical commentary on the creation of Genesis. Judaism and the Doctrine of Creation, which I'm holding here, published by our own Cambridge University Press. Revelation and the God of Israel, and Jewish Faith and Modern Science. These works brought Jewish thinkers to focus on the interplay between science and religion and showed how the biblical text could be better understood in the light of contemporary physics and the life sciences. His most recent books in Jewish philosophy are A User's Guide to Franz Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption and Jewish Philosophy and Historical Introduction. At present, he is involved in two major research projects and writing projects. One is a close philosophical commentary on the traditional rabbinic prayer book, and the other is an intellectual history of the developing concepts of light and in physics and enlightenment in the Abrahamic religions. His Yerusha lecture to us today derives from the second of these projects. It's with great pleasure that I invite him to deliver the 2012 Yerusha lecture under the title Light and Enlightenment, Judaism and Science on the Death and Rebirth of Jewish Philosophy. Professor Samuelson.
Good. Thank you, Nicholas. Let me have an opportunity to thank you now publicly, because I don't know what other opportunity I'll have for what a wonderful host you are for me here for this period. It's an honor to be here. The invitation is an honor, and I really feel privileged to get to deliver this lecture. Nicholas sort of told you what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about what my research project is while I'm here. And because it's my research project, it's not finished. It's only sort of in the middle. So it's hard to hear. I'm going to talk about it from the middle, and then work my way back to the beginning and to the end. And that's so I'll be sure to talk about the middle, because what can happen to me when I talk is I'll start talking about the beginning and never get past it. So let me tell you the structure, and then I'll go to the middle of the beginning. The beginning talks about the project, as Nicholas mentioned. It's an exercise in constructive Jewish thought, and the exercise involves an interface between Judaism and the modern sciences. The premises behind the interface. I'll try not to talk too much about that because I'm a little bit what I want to talk about. Is Judaism is not a single thing, and sciences are not a single thing. They both have histories, and to understand them for, best is to be understood from the historical perspective. Since science is not one thing, science comes out in its past. Judaism also is not one thing, it comes out in its past. That's one major premise. The second major premise is that to understand Judaism at any particular stage is to understand it historically. I won't say anything more about that. So then I think the only way to do constructive Jewish thought is do it through the history, see where the history is going, see where you are in a particular point. And it's by rooting the thought in the history that it deals with the question, is it Jewish, is it authentically Jewish? And then I don't have to discuss that. So the questions that can always be raised. The other premise would be the last premise, and then I'll get to the body of who I want to talk to. And this will be simplistic, and some of you may want to argue with me about it. Judaism, or religion in general, not just Judaism, Judaism and the sciences are concerned with big questions. They do a lot of little questions in the conservative, but they're always concerned with the big questions. Big questions that are quite unpopular today in philosophy. How did the world begin? How did life begin? How will the world end? How will life come to an end? And what does it mean to live? And why does anything exist at all? Sciences ask those questions, and people in religion ask these questions too. And they share in common an interest in the truth. So now I'll give you an equation. There's only one truth. So if they don't agree with each other, somebody's mistaken. They may both be mistaken, and each and the other one may be mistaken, but because they're concerned ultimately with the same questions in very different ways, they have, at least religion, has to pay attention to what the scientists say, because there's equally, at least within Judaism, a commitment that whatever you believe must be true, and we grant the sciences a right to know their truth. So minimally, the concern is to take the issues of conflict and to say that's how it's functioned historically through Judaism. No, I won't go any further with that. I'll go because then I'll start talking about it all the time. Let me go to the middle. And the middle looks like this. I'm going to trace through a history of the concept of life from the Bible up through the 18th century in Judaism. And I'll do a similar tracing of the history of the concept of light in sciences, Western sciences, also again up to the 18th century. The thesis, unproven, but it remains to be seen, runs like this. Since the sciences and Judaism are both part of general culture, as the culture changes, so do the sciences, and some of the religion. And that since they're both part of the same culture, there's an expectation that they will have an impact on each other. Now, that's an expectation. It remains to be seen when you look at each period. But the expectation is that changes in the sciences will have cultural impact. Changes in religious thought will have cultural impact on the way scientists think about what they think. And changes, conversely, changes in sciences will have impact on the way Jews think about that topic. Now, that's the general thesis. I started doing this, as Nicholas said, two books ago, both on critical Jewish concepts. The three central Jewish concepts are creation, revelation, and redemption. The first book was on creation. The second book was on revelation. And this is to be a book about redemption. Of the three, redemption is the hardest. I won't tell you why it's hardest, but the easiest is creation. And the reason creation is easiest is that there's a critical core text. And the critical grotesque is the first three chapters of the book of Genesis. And so the religious side becomes easy, because simply you start with the Genesis text and trace through the development of commentaries on that text up to how far you want to go. Revelation was harder. I won't tell you why it was harder. But redemption is almost impossible. The choice, the decision for impossibility is because what becomes the core text? I'll tell you that briefly. I'll tell you why, just to tell you briefly. There's no biblical text, surprisingly, that serves as a core text for rabbinic discussions of redemption. You would expect that there would be text from Isaiah, but it's not. You would expect it to be text that focus on promise of the coming at the end of days, but it's not. And it turns out to be the daily sitter. And the primary, that it turns out to be the closest thing as a primary text for talking about redemption is, let's call it the logic, what goes on in the Jewish prayer book. Now that entails something, which also may not be popular, but we can talk about it if you want. And that is that Jewish prayer is primarily about redemption. And that view has been somewhat unpopular, well, since Moses Mendelssohn. Again, I won't say anything more than that. But I did decide that as Genesis 1 and 2 should be my prime text for talking about creation from a Jewish perspective, my primary text for talking about redemption from a Jewish perspective would be talking about the prayer. That's all I want to say about that. Now I'm going to start in the middle. So now I'm ready for the first slide. I have one more general thing I'm going to do. Let me do that first. I'm almost going to say. There is a field called Judaism and science, religion and science, and that field has been around at least since the beginning of the 20th century. And the person who's been the key figure on that has been Ian Barwood. Ian Barwood set up four kinds of relationships that there can be between the sciences and religion. You can have a relationship of conflict. That's the one in the world of Richard Dawkins we know best. A second possibility is utter independence of it. Stephen Gold is a defender of utter independence. It's a position go back to a Christian heresy called a verilism and double truth theories, but it's also been around a long time. A third possibility is dialogue, and a fourth possibility is integration. Now, in one book by John Henry Brooke, also called Religion and Science, Brooke argued that these are not four different tendencies, they're always present. So that as you do the history of the relationship between religions and science, you'll find all four elements at play all the time. And that seems to me not obviously true, but true. So as I proceed, that's also going to be how I proceed through my work. Namely, that in the history of talk about Judaism and the sciences, there will always be not conflict, not independence, not dialogue, and not integration, but always an often inseparable mixture of those four elements operating. Now I can begin. I'm going to begin with the biblical text. And this gives you a sort of structural outline of what I want to say about the biblical text with a focus on life. Is that too small to read? As I tell the story of the first book of Genesis, the story of creation breaks down. Well, let's say how I read it. I'm trying to read it solely on the basis of the text in ignorance of any commentaries on the text. That's the goal. So certainly I'm trying to divorce my reading of the text based on the Hebrew text without giving any consideration at this first level of analysis to rabbinic interpretations. And what it comes out to be is something like this. At the beginning, day zero, before there is a creation, at the point before creation, there already exists earth, tohu and bohu, whatever they are, darkness, deep, wind, God, and water. Now, the judgment that there's nothing at all doesn't seem to be what the first verse says. But we'll get to that assumption later. Note that in terms of the time of there being nothing, there's earth and there's water, but there's no air and there's no fire. Now, the expectation would be there should be fire as an element from which the universe is created, and there should be water, but there's not. I made a suggestion about that. The reason there's no word for air is they don't have the notion of the authors, whoever they are, we'll leave that open. The authors don't have a conception of air that stands still. They have a conception of air in motion, and the air in motion would be wind. That leads open the question, where is the fire? And the best candidate around for fire is God. Now, I'll throw in something from left field at this point, a suggestion, a problematic suggestion, which is some of the problems with this. In Stoicism, there are four elements, two active and two passive. The passive elements are water and air. The active elements are fire and air. In fact, the God of the Stoics is a combination of those two active elements. This is an interface of active air, moving air, wind, with moving fire. Now, if I could use that, which is problematic, but if I can use it, and I will use that, then that would leave open the suggestion that fire is God. And if we expect fire as elements, which are common not just to the Greeks, but throughout the Mediterranean world, the association of God with fire would be apparent. And indeed, most of the appearances of God throughout the biblical text are always in forms of fire. Now, the word for creation that takes place, the verb to create, egreshal, in its simple form, the kal form, always occurs with God as the subject, and the earth as the object. That root is used in other forms with other meanings, but in that simple form, the kal form, this is its only meaning. Whatever it means, God's always the subject, and the world is always the object. Now, if that's right, then create is not the best translation for the word bara. If yatsar would be a better word, asa would be a better word, but not bara. What bara is something that God uniquely does to the world. So, in lack of another word for that, let's change bara Elohim as God gods. Now, what God's godding is like, no one knows. And the text doesn't tell us, and that's also appropriate to the text, since the verb in that form, we don't know what it means. We do know what it means from other forms, and that's useful. In other forms, it can be used for things like separating the curds from whey, separating the milk, if it is to do it. It's used for being healthy, it's used for being fat. So put all that together kind of roughly. The verb used in its other form says something about making separations that are ultimately separations that make it better. Now, if you look at the other word, the rest of the story of the creation, except for that first act of creation, that's what happens in the story. Everything that's created is already there. What God does is he takes things that are already there, puts separations in them, and calls them good. And that would fit the other uses, but not Torah. There's only one thing God makes, and on some common interpretations, he may not make that. I'll come back to that. But the only thing God makes is light. Now, there will be some commentaries that say that the light is made out of the darkness. But saying literally with the text, since it doesn't say the light came, is made out of the darkness, we have this one entity called light that's put into the midst of the darkness. And the purpose of putting the light into the midst of the darkness is to make a separation. Again, what's the separation? The separation is between day and night. Now, note that from the text. God makes light, and it's put into the midst of the darkness. And the area that's called light is called day, and the area that's called night is called, the area that's dark is called night. Now, if that's right, if that's what the text is saying, then the words day and night have nothing to do with time. They're spatial terms, and they have to do with spatial separation. Nothing in the story suggests anything in time until we get to the second day. So the way I like to think of the divisions of the day is with transparencies. It's only a metaphor. With transparencies, you take multiple transparencies, put the layers on top of each other, and then you get a total picture through the transparencies. Consider each day a transparency. And then you get the total picture of the end of the universe. But it's not to say there's a universe each day. There's a universe only at the end. So there are no time references in the Genesis story. Rather, the day and night references are, these are different stages of the act of creation. Until we get time, and that's at the beginning of chapter 2. And the creator, God makes rest, Shabbat, and that's a time distinction. So we have at each stage our evolutions in space with a final evolution in time that gives us a week. Word about a week. I start my watch. No, wait, I never started my watch. You're going to have to tell me when to start because I forgot to start my watch. Oh, yeah, it won't help me. Well, you just tell me what time it is. Yeah, I lost that. Let me move on. So we have the one thing that God makes, and he makes light, and that's to make a distinction between the days, but there's spatial designation. Then he makes this thing called a rakia, which is always hard to translate. The verb means to stretch out, so you could call it a stretcher. But it's a something. Text doesn't say what it is. But it's a something to take the water, separate the waters. The image is this. On day zero, meaning before day, but remember, day has nothing to do with time. But before the day, you have a globe of earth, meaning solid, surrounded by a ring of water, surrounded by a ring of Ruach Elohim, divine wind, and if the Stoic interpretation is right to fit it, then it's surrounded by a ring of a mixture of fire and air. The Rakia is put between into that circle of water, that ring of water that's surrounding the earth, to have this, again, a separation, a division between what will become upper water and lower water. At this stage, it's only upper water because he hasn't moved the land around yet. That comes later. But when the land gets moved around, we'll be able to have water underneath and water above. Then the waters are put in piles so that the surface of that sphere has dry parts and wet parts. And the wet parts are called seas, and the dry parts are called dry land, earth. Now note that within those first 3 days, the initial divisions, The divisions are all divisions of space. And then when all the space is put into its proper place, then the next thing is to create occupants of the space. And they're the occupants. On day four, you get lighters in the sky, or wrote things that make light. And they're presumably the sun, the moon, and the stars, but it doesn't say that. It just says two big lighters and lighters. Then you get objects that are in the sky, presumably birds. Then you get objects that are in the water, and they're told to reproduce. Note that the agent of creation on those days is all the earth itself. For Jewish thought, astronomy is far more problematic than is biology. Or it should be. Today it isn't, but it should be more problematic than biology. Because biology is really easy to reconcile with the text. Astronomy is hard. You should have rockets go off into space through a ring of water. And there's no ring of water. So a prima facie astronomy is that. The fact that everything comes out of the dirt is not a chiddush. It's not new to the text. The assumption is that all creatures, land, water, and earth, come from a common thing, which is earth. So what is the issue? Now, there are things that could be the issue. But just to say, there's a question for people who do history of science, history of religion, why has there been all this focus on biology, where the natural place to have the focus should be astronomy? And we have some problems with astronomy in the 17th century, but I think that was a distinctively Christian problem in the 17th century. But the biology now is structurally mysterious. Why did you cause so much trouble? There are some guesses. These are only guesses. One is an understanding. And the guess is this, that biology is done in English. Physics is not. And it's a distinct advantage to accepting what physicists say, that what they really say can't be said in the vernacular. It can only be said mathematically. So whenever a scientist says anything in English, he's not saying the way it is. He's giving us a bad metaphor for saying what he's saying mathematically. That's easier to work with. That's a guess. But in any case, modern physics has not been abandoned. It is at the center of working astronomy. Where I live, at University of Arizona, there is a major Vatican Observatory for working astronomy. They don't have problems with that anymore. But again, biology, I don't know why. Jews who have never had a problem with biology, unless you're then fasting, now do have a problem with biology. Why they have a problem with biology, I'm also not sure. But the anti-Darwinian kind of positions that you find with fundamentalist Christians in America, you now find with many observant Jews in America too. My suspicion, this is a tangent, my suspicion is there are cultural similarities in the ultra-Orthodox community and in the Christian fundamentalist community, and that the real cause is not anything in Aryan Judaism, but because of the strong cultural affinity shared by these two lesser liberal groups. But that's only a bit. Now, let me give some general features about light. Note, while the biblical text talks about light, it doesn't talk about vision. I should tell you something before that. The light that's there on day one doesn't exist. How do I know it doesn't exist? Two reasons. One, the light that we know about comes from lighters. That's on day four. Sun and stars. we're talking about day one, and on day one there isn't that light. So the light that we know of isn't here anymore. What became of it, and what is that light like? The biblical text tells us nothing about it, except it's not here anymore. Now, the only insight that we get into it that way is what? The dark is an absolute dark, and the light is an absolute light. And we have no idea what an absolute light is or an absolute dark is. Try to think of light without dark. And the truth is, there's nothing to think, because without change, you can't see it. Because a perfect light and a perfect dark are both regions in which there is no vision. Now, for the biblical text, vision is not the issue. Nothing is raised about vision. I could add a footnote in there too. And the footnote is vision is a deprived sense in the biblical text. The scriptures read as if they were written by a blind person. Now, it would be kind of nice, you know, we know what Moses said. We have no idea what he looked like. Right? We have a good idea of Abraham's personality. Was he tall? Was he short? Did he have a fuzzy beard? Did he have a short beard? Was he bald? Right? There's nothing to suggest that the people, persons recording the text, could see. Right? Primarily, they could hear. Now, in the Mediterranean world, blind prophets are not unusual. So there's something almost, if you have a thesis that the Hebrew scriptures are part of a general Mediterranean culture, then that the author of the Hebrew script, authors of the Hebrew scriptures were blind would be reasonable. I don't know that, you don't know that, but it's a nice possibility. It's a nice hope. In any case, the Hebrew scriptures are wonderful for blind people. They're in no sense essentially deprived in reading the Hebrew scriptures. The only exception to that is the opening chapter of the book of Ezekiel. But it turns out that what is being introduced isn't described anyway. Right? The opening of the book of Ezekiel, which is our most graphic visual description in all of the Bible, tells us about this throne and these wheels. And then we get this elaborate visual description of the stone. And then on top of the throne is a man sitting on a chair. And above the man sitting on the chair comes a voice, and the voice is the voice of God. But the voice is not coming from the man. And while the chair is alive, because it has eyes and it moves, it's still not the voice that's speaking, which is what the text was all about. So even in Ezekiel, which gives us the most detailed visual description, his visual description has nothing to do with what he's talking about, which is the appearance of God. Note again that there's no connection, that the light has nothing to do with vision. Now the question becomes, one, what's the light? And two, where is it? Because it doesn't exist in our world. And the biblical text tells us nothing about it. That's all I want to think about that. I mean, do I want to go into the next step? I may not yet. I want to see what the next slide is. No. Okay. The next step, while I'm looking at the rabbinic material, is the Midrash. The Midrash, which for Jewish readers of the text are inseparable from the biblical text. The text is always read together with the Midrashic interpretations of the text. So to a point that it becomes part of what the text means. So if you talk about Jewish Bible, you're talking naturally about just the biblical text. You're talking the biblical text with layers of commentary on it that begin with the Midrash picture. These initial questions that I raised, you begin to get answers in the Midrash. So I now will give you a Midrashic answer to the questions. Not because we're talking about what the text really says, but we're talking about how the text functions for subsequent and different stages of Jewish understandings. When the sin occurs, whatever the sin is, and there's a long debate in the rabbinic tradition about what constitutes the sin. Several answers are given. I'll give you just briefly one interpretation. The serpent says to the woman, why don't she eat? I have some fruit, because at that point they didn't eat the fruit of the tree, they were eating the trees. It says the trees are food. It doesn't say just the fruit of the trees are food. So presumably the trees are edible. So they're eating the fruit trees. It's not the fruit bearing trees. It's the fruit trees, which are just the trees. I mean, the trees themselves are the fruit. The serpent says to the woman, "Why don't you?" She says, "I can't. God, I can't eat it because," summary quotes, "God said, you shall neither eat nor touch the fruit lest you die." First of all, the woman hadn't created you. So how does she know what God said? That's one. Two, God didn't say, don't eat or touch the fruit of the tree. God said, don't eat the fruit. Didn't say not to touch it. So what does the serpent do? He pushes her against the tree. And he says, you see, nothing happened when you touch the tree. Nothing will happen if you eat the tree. Now, gets that better. What's the sin? Well, the rabbis give several suggestions appropriate to the culture of their time. One of the leading suggestions is, that's what happens to a man when he teaches Torah to his wife. So there are multiple levels of sin occurring. One, the man has given up his authority to her in the house. He told her she's not in his control. Two, he's teaching lessons when he shouldn't be doing. Three, she misunderstands the text. So the whole thing happens from the source. So there's a lot of interpretations of what this is. Whatever the sin is, which is not clear, the consequence of the sin is that the universe diminishes. Now, we're given several signs of how the universe diminishes because of whatever the sin was. One, God created two big lights, which presumably are the sun and the moon. And there's no differentiation made between the big lights, which suggests they're the same size. So one of the things that happens to the universe is the moon declines in size relative to the sun. Two, the light that is the light has been removed. Three, serpents at creation could stand up on feet and talk. Right? After whatever the sin is, they can't stand up on feet anymore and begin. Four, serpents and humans can be lovers. After the sin, they're not lovers anymore. Right? One is always concentrated and destroyed by the other. So the universe itself has changed as a result. Now we can say, what is the light like? As the universe is created, it's created perfect, which means the universe is an objectification of God. Because only God is perfect. Now, the light is how God sees. Or, as the Midrash says, with the light of creation, you can see from one end of the universe to the other. At any time in the history of the universe, from its beginning to end, in a single glance. that's the way God sees. God sees everything, knows everything, because with that light, you see simultaneously everything, past, present, future. So what's been removed is the light of divine vision. Now, note that for the first time, there's a suggestion of vision. Up till now, there's nothing, to suggest that light has anything to do with vision. With that, I want to stop the reality. And now, go to the Greeks. I'll come back to the eye. No, come back. Not too far. There we are. The primary concern with the Greeks was not in the nature of light, but in the nature of vision. And all of the conversations are concerned not about what light is, but are conversations about what vision is. Now, three views emerge as dominant views in a common vision. One view that's called an intromission theory of vision, that the light originates in the object and is transmitted to the eye, and Democritus, Epicurus, and Lucretius are noted for that. Two is what's called the extromission theory, which that the light originates in the soul behind the eye and transmitted to the object. And that's Plato, that's Euclid, that's Ptolemy, and Alcimus. And then there's the Aristotelian position, which will, by the rise of the Muslim period, become the dominant position, though it was not at first. The first position was considered the least believable, and it's the one that's closest to what we think is true. What was wrong with it is this. Your eye is only so big. And if the light is entering from the object, the amount of light that should be able to enter through your eye should be very tiny. So, you shouldn't be able, with your eye, to see a mountain. Because if the light is coming from the object, only a very small part of the object will be visible. Now, that's one problem. The second problem is, if the light is coming from the object itself, why don't we see the light coming from the object? Because if we stand off to the side, we should be able to see a stream of light. And we can't see a stream of light. So they thought that was less likely to. Now, on the first problem, for the solution to the first problem has to do with light bending in different media. So they needed a geometry of light bending as it moves through lenses, as it moves from one media to another, and they begin to develop a pure geometry of how light can bend so light from a larger object can become focused on a single point. And the ones who were doing that primarily were mathematicians, not the philosophers. On the second theory, the second theory was far more popular than the Adamist position. What was nice about being in the Platonic position is that the light originates in the soul. And there is, because of the influence of the Platonic view, the view that vision has to do with fire, and fire comes from that element fire, which is the nature of the soul. So the soul is believed to be something encased behind the eye, and vision is therefore taken as a sign of it. But it still also has the problem of how you bend the light. That would be the pure mechanics of how you're able to see, again, objects that are bigger than your eye. What will emerge by the second century is the dominant position, is Aristotle's position. And Aristotle's position is the hardest of them all. I should be ending, yes? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So I'll do Aristotle's real fast. I spent too much time on the Bible. In Aristotle's position, there are rays that come from the fire of the soul behind the eye, and rays that come from the object itself, combining the two previous positions. Aristotle likes to do that. Aristotle likes to make his positions emerge out of combining the positions before. And then those waves of light, not waves yet, those beams of light are heated by the sun as they pass through the air. And then the only thing that Aristotle had right is that you get a wave because of the heating action of the sun. And light, which is associated primarily with color, is due to that heating action. Now, just know, the concept of soul with fire and heat is Greek influence. If I can watch that, the idea of God itself represents a common Mediterranean influence that comes up, that's recognizable through Stoicism. And then once this view of light becomes adopted, then the scientists themselves become Muslims, Jews, and Christians. It begins to affect their way of seeing things. And that brings me up to the Middle Ages. Now, that's all I have time for. So now let me jump to the end. 5 minutes? Through a set of Christian influences, beginning with the Christian discoverer of a Muslim named Al-Khazin. Al-Khazin is 10th century. Christians discovered in the 12th century. Robert Grosseteste has a great deal to do with that discovery. Through alchemy, they adopt what will turn to be basically the correct view of how vision occurs. Not theory of light yet, but how vision occurs. And that's the picture.
There it is.
It's hard to see this fish. They now have a good picture of the anatomy of the eye. And, I point here. Do you see it here? No, you don't see it right there. There's a lens on the left, and the light comes through the lens and it's bent. And then it goes onto the it goes through the pupil of the eye, where there's another surface that bends the light as it comes through, and it gets focused on, the light gets focused up from the optic nerve, and then transmitted through the optic nerve to the brain, where the picture is formed. And they know this. They know this by the 13th century. The problem is, it doesn't make any sense. It happens to be true, but it doesn't make any sense. And the reason it doesn't make any sense is that the geometry of the bending of the light means everything is upside down. So they think something must be missing. And so that they don't have the picture of the eye correct yet, because the picture keeps going out upside down. And then Kepler figures out in the 17th century, and it is, the eye does give you the picture upside down. We see everything upside down. Anatomically, we see everything upside down. And then our brain says, it's upside down. Then our brain turns it around, which is really interesting, because it means that vision only happens in the brain. Now, 17th century becomes extremely important. In other words, seeing is believing is just not true. No one believes what they say, because if they believe what they say, they see everything upside down. When the camera is invented, the camera gives them a graphic illustration of what vision is like, and you look through the camera and see everything upside down. Now, that has a lot to do, people like Clarity and others have argued, with the move to pure rationalism, with people like Descartes in the 17th century who knew just physically that seeing what you see isn't what's there, it's like seeing through a camera, which isn't reality. And that the major growths in philosophy are not growths in empirical philosophy, they're growths in rationalism. Hold that on the side for a moment. Now pick up one of the students. I'm about to end it this year. When Christ returns for the Christians, or the Messiah comes for the Jews, it's often hard to keep this two separate. When what's happening happens, what will happen is everyone will be enlightened. It will be the age of enlightenment. What does the age of enlightenment mean? That light that's been hoarded away since the fall on the seventh day of creation will come back, and then we will all see as God sees. Now, for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which are the miracle, everyone, Jews, Muslims, and Christians, are expecting the Messiah to come or return, whatever the difference is, somewhere around the 17th century, or in the 17th century. The one of the many Jews who through history have said they were the Messiah, the only Jew who ever called himself the Messiah that lots of Jews believed, came in the 17th century. Right? That's 7 times 3. So there is a setting there in expectation of the coming of the Messiah. Now, I'm going to make a huge jump, because I have like 60 seconds left. But I probably have to go over that. But now I'm going to make the hugest jump of all. The Messiah only begins the process. That's the days of the Messiah. That's the beginning. But it's only the beginning. What the Messiah sets up is the Messianic age. And Messianic age, otherwise called the Kingdom of God. So beyond the days of the Messiah is the Kingdom of God. And then the Kingdom of God, that's not the whole story. There's a stage after the Kingdom of God, and that's called the end. Now, we know a little bit like what the end is about. In the end, from Isaiah, in the end, there's only light and there's no dark. What does that mean? No one can see anything. So, because in a world where there's only dark and no light, there's nothing to see. Without shadows, you can't see. Which means the end is the end of everything. So this is an end that they presumably like. Nietzsche will pick that up and say, Jews and Christians, Christians because of Jews, are all nihilists. And the reason they're nihilists is their vision is universal death. Well, a vision of universal life is also a vision of universal death. Everything is over. Now, I think, without any evidence whatsoever, that the French Revolution is the Kingdom of God. And what the French Revolution is that coming of the kingdom to be expected. And the reason it is a humanist kingdom of God is because when the kingdom of God comes, we will all have enlightenment. Which really means we see as God sees. So I hope something like that emerges, but I'll accept whatever does emerge. And I think that's a good place to start.
Well, we have had some wide-ranging lectures in this faculty in the past, but I can't remember one which is quite as wide-ranging as to go from before the creation of the world, at least to the French Revolution, if not to our own time. And
well, the book may never be written, so you never know.
And Professor Samuelson has kindly said that he will deal with any questions, comments, or objections. So now's your chance.
And we're looking at it all, and maybe you can give me some.
Janet, I saw you scribbling away
frantically. No, but copying down the wisdom. But you invoke the static, the Stoic rather, elements, and we're happy. Although you said you didn't want to read anything into the exegesis of Genesis, you did happily plug them in, and your explanation of that seemed to be that really they antedate Stoic culture. They're just a generic. Mediterranean cosmology, is that what you would
say? Yeah, I think that's what's behind that would be one, there's a lot of things behind it that we can spell out. Well, we don't know when the Hebrew scriptures were precisely when the Hebrew scriptures were codified. Now, the level of the question is something like this. If you look at all the elements of a text, they can come from all kinds of periods. But then comes the editor, and the editor puts together, and it's their text. It's the editor's text. So, if the goal is to make sense out of the Hebrew scriptures, not different texts within the Hebrew scriptures, if the goal is to make sense, conceptual sense, out of the Hebrew scriptures, who are the editors? And when do they edit? And what's true of their world? Now, if you take that kind of perspective on the text, the Hebrew Scriptures is very late. All kinds of parts of it are not late, but the Hebrew Scriptures is pretty late. That's one thing. And that's the perspective. I'm not trying to say who wrote the Genesis story, but treating it as part of the Hebrew Scriptures in general. And that could be, I guess, you tell me how far we go. 200 CE? At the time of the Mishnah? It's clearly done before the time of the Mishnah. That also raises interesting things about the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. If you start Judaism with the Hebrew Scriptures, then Judaism and Christianity are sister religions. Dependency of one on the other, both responding to the same kind of situation. That's the same. Whatever it is, how early is Stoicism? That's one sort of thing to think about. Another sort of thing to think about is a common Mediterranean culture, certainly from the point of the Greek Empire on, makes sense. And since so much of the biblical stories have matching Greek stories, why Greek? Why pick on the Greeks? There is a common culture to the Mediterranean world. There remains a common culture to the Mediterranean world until modern times. Why not see common cultural parallels? When did the Stoics speak? Does that seem unreasonable?
No, I just wondered why you were willing to do it, but I think you've explained it.
I don't feel confident about it, absolutely anything. But that's what I'm doing. That's it. Oh.
Yes, I think at the back. Is it not?
Your comment that the Midrash allows God to see the past, present, and future. So does that, are you allowing modern technology with the ability to see the redshift allows mankind to see what God sees?
Tell me what you're thinking.
Just a comment.
No, it's funny because you have something in mind.
Well, the redshift, the ability to see galaxies move out. Ah. Is this, are you sort of implying that mankind with scientific technology allows?
I wasn't thinking of that. Why not? I'm sorry, I'm too sorry about that. When I was in college, American poet Kashikuro came to speak, and I had just read his poems on creation, and I had total confidence I knew what he was talking about. So with the arrogance I could only have as a high school junior, a college junior, I sat at a table with him in my class, and I told Kashikuro what he meant in the poem. And I went on about it. And after his reading, he said to me, "Well, I could have meant that, yeah." So then, you know, why not? So that's how I feel about that. I hadn't been thinking in those kind of terms at all. But I don't want to rule it out. That's why I was interested in what you might have said. What I'm seeking is something else. And standard medieval argument is we cannot know what God knows because the world as God created is infinite, and God can understand the infinite because we are infinite. I mean, God's infinite. But since we are finite, we can't understand anything as God understands. Except, certainly from Descartes on, we can understand infinity. We have set theory to tell us what infinity is like. So, if we've now reached the state that we can do calculus, which also requires infinite calculation, and we're in a position through set theory to make the logic out of the infinite, doesn't that mean we know like God knows for those medieval standards? And don't you suspect at least that those 17th century fellows like Descartes really did think they had God's vision? And they had God's vision because they had the calculus, because they had grasped infinity. So the language that made divine knowledge possible becomes mathematics. Mathematics is the divine language. And that's part of the secularization of messages. That's what I'm saying. Yes, sir.
There was another question. Was there another question at the back? I didn't see. Michael Lowy. Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping you could enlighten me and refresh a memory which is now several decades old, but I recall as a teenager attending readings of the Bereshith Rabbah of the Midrash Rabbah of Bereshith, attended by very learned scholars of this university, specialists in Assyrian matters, specialists in Christianity, Christian theology, specialists in Greek literature and history. And it came over those meetings, time and time again, the question of how far Greek concepts of cosmology had made their way into the minds of the rabbis. Now, memory gets rather slack over a large number of decades. I'm talking the 1930s. If there is a quick answer to that one, I'd be very glad to hear it.
I'll appeal to authorities, better authorities than me, I'm Jewish. There's been a lot of consideration lately in Midrashics by scholars in Midrash about Hellenistic influences. More than they used to think there was. I'll mention two people in particular. One is Jacob Nessler, who's talked a great deal about how to understand Midrash philosophically. But the philosophical model for understanding Midrash is stone. That's like one extreme. The other two is a very careful, precise scholars, for me in many ways, a paradigm of careful scholarship. There's Henry Fischel, from Indiana University, who has a very insightful article on Stoic influence in rabbinic thought. So I refer you to Henry Fischel. I'll be safe. I feel safe with the Henry Fischel reference. But the essay of thinking about Stoic, it's really from the Fischel article that I really began to think about parallels between the Stoicism and the rabbinic literature. And it's effectively an occasion. Like, the word, this is just a small example, the word halacha, shouldn't that be translated as law? First of all, it's not law. It needs a way. And the Talmud, in particular, is not a book of law. It doesn't decide law. There's lots of codes that decide law. The Talmud doesn't decide law. It has discussions from something called Torah in terms of examining something called halacha, and everything is in the discussion. Now, the people who are doing this discussion are called chachamim. So we have these wise men who are sitting and talking in about the way to Torah, whatever Torah is, and the activity from which they're developing rules to guide you on your way towards a goal whose goal is Chochmah or Sophia or wisdom. It sounds like Stoicism. The whole thing can be translated into Stoic terms. And so that's because of Fischel. But I'm not an expert in the lyrics, but Fischel is. So we rely on his word.
Hmm. Yeah. Actually, you've reminded me of the comment on a verse in the Mishnah which talks about geometry and astronomy being what there's a Greek word which is normally understood as being peripheral or,
yes,
or to wisdom.
Yes.
But the late professor of classics in Jerusalem, Adi Wasserstein, said that the text should be read slightly differently, and he read it as propaideia, as propaideia. In fact, mathematics is the first step towards philosophy for rabbinic students as well, for rabbinic students as well as for Greek philosophers. So, yes, Daniel.
Thank you very much for your talk. And I wonder, in speaking about light and vision, in what you've been researching so far, does this get at all connected with notions of, as you're talking about with Torah, if Torah could be seen as enlightening the eyes? Is there any sense then? Just looking at this diagram here, it seems like you could draw parallels with the act of interpreting text, interpreting Torah as a form of seeing,
yes,
and whether the particular hermeneutical approaches would correspond also to different theories,
yes,
of vision as,
yes,
well.
Yes.
Could you just comment? Is that...
No, it's yours.
Okay.
Do it.
Yeah, okay.
I give you one kind of concern. I just finished a book about the 13th and just finished 13th, 17th century and the interplay between the new sciences and the occult sciences. And of course there's been a lot of interest in that since people have been working here on Newton's papers. And Newton was the paradigm of the Enlightenment. And it turns out, for all the time he spent on math and physics, he spent more time on alchemy and other occult stuff. And more is coming out of people of that period who have been involved with occult stuff. The person who made the strongest imprint that way was at the University of London, Francis Yates, as she used it. And Francis Yates wrote this important book on Bruno, which basically suggested, and she's been attacked a lot, but the book has not. She is, she wrote the book in the 1960s, and it still dominates the field of historians of this period. And that is this simple image of the Age of Enlightenment, as an age of materialist, positivist, positivism, materialism. It's just not true. And these people were involved with alchemy, and they were involved with all the movement we would today call occult sciences, and didn't see them as a god. And who says that Newton's idea of power is a mathematical model? The French did that in the 18th century. They turned it into a mathematical model. In the 17th century, Newton was probably thinking of alchemy when he talked about powers and attractions and repulsions. That's it. So the whole thing is just, it's not as neat as we want to make it. Now, having said that, I was going to say, from that book, what's troubling in this. There's this one essay in the book. I have to check who wrote it. Who wants to make a radical distinction between scientific thinking and everybody else's thinking, which for him is occult. And the major characteristic of the non-scientific thinking is we talk about things we don't know in principle. Almost nothing in the humanities is provable. Some things are more reasonable than other things, but it's the nature of what we study that we make uncertain judgments. We try to be as reasonable as can be, but what you hope for in the humanities is not to know the truth. What you hope for in the humanities is to be reasonable. And this article was written against that. And I said, am I guilty of that? Do I do that? Do I settle for being reasonable rather than knowing? Well, yeah, of course I do. That's why I'm in the humanities and I'm not in a science. So I just mentioned that in passing.
Thank you. Well, the time has come when we have to draw the formal discussion to an end. However, thanks to the generosity of Steven Spielberg and the faculty, we can continue the discussion upstairs in a sort of symposiastic form.
Thank you very much over a drink.
I would like to thank you very much. It's clear that what we've heard is just footprints or pointers to much, much deeper and wider thoughts, which I hope that you'll be able to share with us today and during your stay here. But thank you very much for giving us the 2012 Yerusha lecture.
Thank you for your time.